You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Barney Sherman, it's a good Sunday morning. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good Sunday morning to you. So, flashback in time, July 2017, we had legendary coach Robin Selvig and Megan Harrington, a former Lady Grizz player, and at that point in time, the producer of a film about Rob called The House That Rob Built. And now it just dropped in late February. So there's been a 3.5, almost 4-year period of time from when they were contemplating this thing hitting the street, so to speak, you know, and when it's finally been released and put into, syndication in a way. It's on multimedia platforms. It's on Amazon Prime Video. It's getting early, really great reviews. But it's interesting, and I know you know about this, and from your past documentary film experience, I would have thought at the time, and I remember thinking at the time, this is going to hit right away, right? They're making it. It's going to be out. And here we are, you know, in March of 2021, and it's just hit the streets. So I'm very interested in finding out the story about, you know, where it's been, what's been going on, you know, and then some things about Megan herself and how she's been adapting and adjusting to the world of Hollywood, particularly in the time of COVID.
Absolutely. It's always good to revisit a guest and see the progress that they've made with their project, and just thankful that she's got it made and it's getting great reviews and has distribution. How wonderful is that? So what a great story.
Yeah, terrific.
Back after this with our guest, Megan Harrington, and the film, The House That Rob Built.
Hi.
We're back with our guest, Megan Harrington, senior producer of Family Theater Productions and the director, producer, and brainchild, the originator of the film, The House That Rob Built.
Hey, Megan. How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Arnie Scott, it's so good to be with you this afternoon.
So for our listeners that don't know you, let me just give a capsulized version of Megan Harrington. This isn't quite This Is Your Life, but these are the things that I know best about you. Former Lady Grizz player, captain of the team, NCAA Women of the Year in 2000, 7 years at the Montana World Trade Center as managing director, the last 11 years in Hollywood doing all sorts of motivational and faith-based films, the film biographer of Robin Selvig in The House That Rob Built, you know, number 24 in our program, but number one in our art. That's the way I remember Megan. I do have to share one story, Scott, about Megan. She worked for me for 7 years at the World Trade Center, and my tutelage of her didn't last very long. She quickly mastered the international business world and was one of my best hires. But we had a trade mission in Ireland, and as with many of our missions, if we go to a country, we put a press release out and invite anybody that has Montana ties. And sure enough, we're having a reception with free food and drinks, and Megan shows up. And I didn't know her very well at that point. I knew of her just by reputation, but I saw how well she mingled with everybody and how she just fit in so well. And I went up to her and said, if you ever come back to Montana, there's a place for you at the Montana World Trade Center. And Megan did come back to Montana, and there was a place for her at the World Trade Center. But the best part of that story is right after I hired her, I get a phone call at my office from her mother and father, you know, and Vince and Marie. And I've never gotten a phone call from parents of an employee before, so I wasn't sure what this was about. And they said, can we meet with you? And they came to the office at the University of Montana and came, and they brought me a box of chocolate, box of candy, and thanked me for bringing Megan back to America and back to Missoula, Montana. So that was one of the best, most endearing stories.
Megan, did you know that they were doing that? Did you know they were doing that?
No, I would have stopped that, Scott. I would have stopped that in its tracks, and I would have taken the chocolate.
Right. Yeah. So, Megan, in July of 2017, you and the legendary coach Robin Selvig were on our show, our radio show, talking about this film. So what the heck has happened in 3.5 years?
Oh, my goodness. A lot. A lot has happened in 3.5 years. At that point when we spoke, probably didn't know how much longer we had at that time to get to this point. But we released February 23rd, so last month. And so it's a little bit of a wild ride since then. But to think three and a half years later that here we are again now with an update. Is it good? Actually, you know what? That's how long sometimes it takes to get a film from conception to birth into a theater or online.
And I do want to say that so far since it dropped, and it's only dropped a few weeks ago, it's scoring 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know if you know that, but it is.
Good.
It's on Amazon Prime Video. You can see it. So it's on a major streaming platform. You're getting rave reviews from people as diverse as Chelsea Clinton and John Stockton, the legendary Hall of Fame basketball player and coach. Trish Vandeveer, probably the greatest women's basketball coach of all time. And many, many others are just saying this is a film that anybody that cares about not only basketball and not only women, but, you know, this whole migration from Title IX, you know, 44 years ago when it was first launched, you're giving women equality in sports. And that's one of the, you know, one of the threads and one of the great accomplishments and achievements of Coach Selvig that you captured very well, not by, you know, touting it, by listening to the players. You did what, 70 interviews in this film?
Yes. About close to 70. Players, though, you're probably about right, 60-ish. I mean, we wish we could have interviewed every single player. But, you know, just with time and budget, that just was not possible. But it would have been wonderful to have all of those, of all the players that have played for him. And you just saying that, it's speaking to people, is the most wonderful part about seeing it released, is that's what our goal was, that this spoke to a general audience about the greatness of women's basketball set in our incredible state. It's an amazing story of what happened here.
I mean, you were a player for him about halfway through the middle of his career, right? He retired in 2016. You played for him from, what, 98 to 2000, somewhere in there. So you're about halfway. So what was women's basketball like then?
Well, as I remember it, even growing up, and I think I became more aware of it as we were filming, I didn't understand or appreciate it the way that I did as I started working on the film, is we had an incredible following for women's basketball in Missoula. I mean, most little girls were running around this city and this state dreaming of being a Lady Grizz, of that as what they wanted most in life. And I don't know that you'd find that in very many places. Certainly not at that time. You know, it's grown a lot. A lot of great advances have been made. So I was just in this world that was normal. That was totally normal. And you go to a game and there's more girls. I mean, more people at a women's game sometimes.
It was normal for you to see more people in the stands at the women's game than at the men's game, which is very unusual in college basketball.
You play in front of
several thousand people, and then you go on the road and play in front of, what, 200 people?
Yeah, and that's when you could really hear them also. That's really loud and clear. So the radio would be an interesting place to be listening to him on those away games, I'm sure.
Right. So for our listeners, some of them who may be new to, you know, the Missoula area, to our listening audience, Rob Selvig, had a 38-year head coaching career of the Lady Grizz. He retired in 2016. His stat line is phenomenal. I mean, 865 wins, 24 conference championships, 21 NCAA appearances, 21 times Coach of the Year in the Big Sky. One of the top 10 winningest coaches of all time comes out of Missoula, Montana. You know, and so that for our audience is just staggering numbers. And he became the coach of a women's team when it was unusual for a man to coach a women's team.
Well, and also just for him to take that job, he's coming out of, I mean, he had said, I wasn't sure of leaving my high school women's coaching job to go to college. If that frames it for anybody, that was risky because you didn't know where it was headed. His high school job was more secure. So he takes over. He played for the men's team and did not know at the time that there was a women's program. So yeah, this was a very right. much unknown program that he comes into and embraces it as his own.
I mean, even today's world, fast forward to 2021, you go to a major college basketball operation and you look at the men's operation and you look at the women's operation and they're not the same. I mean, I don't care where you go. Mm-mm. You know, unless maybe it's at UConn or Baylor or someplace like that that's won national championships. I mean, I remember seeing the locker rooms back in those days, you know, one set of barbells for women, you know, and a small little operation. And the men's side of it had this huge operation. I mean, you had, you know, to compete and play at the highest level with a disadvantage compared to men, even with Title IX initially.
Yeah, and those initial trailblazers who were a part of his first years, certainly his first team and beyond. I mean, what an example of playing for love of the game, of being given an opportunity when they didn't have one before and saying, I don't care what's in the weight room. I don't care what's in the locker room right now. I get a chance to play. Now, of course, things needed to be addressed and progress had to be made, but they're coming in, you know, think of the mindset of coming in. I get this chance to play. And then Rob, in his position, went on to say, okay, you know, they deserve this and they deserve this. And he did it in a way that really only Rob can do of collaborating and saying, okay, this has to be changed. We need to make these improvements because my girls deserve it. But these girls didn't even have a chance in college. They're getting this wonderful opportunity. So that, I just can't even imagine being in their shoes, of that being overwhelming in and of itself, of this great opportunity. And then to have somebody who's fighting for you and making sure you get what you need. I mean, it's
he was one of the early recruiters of Native American players. I mean, as Rob said many times, he didn't look at you as women or girls. Mm-hmm. He looked at you as athletes and kind of treated you as athletes. That was his way and approach. And Scott, that was a very sane way to deal with it, you know, during a long career. You couldn't be race conscious. You couldn't be gender conscious. You had to be focused on, you're an athlete, I'm trying to get the most out of you.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's conveyed in the film.
Well, that's innovative too, right? Yes. There. And 78, to be come in with that mindset, to bring that to practice. You know, imagine the girls, him showing up with that mindset. What I mean, like, whoa, no one's really ever expected that of us. No one has really called us to that level. And you see a woman in the film, Linda Deaton, who was in his first team, saying that elevates you as a young woman and a player. That brought me to a new level because he believed in them. I mean, how many times has someone, even unconsciously, they didn't know it, said a word to us or gave us some sort of encouragement they didn't know you needed to hear, and what it did for your confidence and your ability to believe that what you thought wasn't possible was. And he did that with his team.
Were you able to, through making the film, get to understand the psychology of Robin and as to why he approached it this way? Because it really was very much ahead of its time. And what in his psychology, put him in a place to kind of treat you and the sport and the team the way he did?
See, Rob is, I mean, he's such a simple person. He grew up as...
I'm going to tell him that.
Yeah. You tell him. He's very common. He's just very common. No. He grew up as one of eight children. So he had sisters. I mean, his mother was incredible and an athlete, I think, in and of herself. So it wasn't came in, and he said this over and over. It's just, he didn't come in, I'm going to do all these things. It's just how he was. Well, I expect you to play, and I know you're capable of being able to do that, so I'm going to expect it from you. It was probably something he learned from his family, from his own mom and dad, about what it means to strive for excellence and be excellent and expect that of whatever situation you're put in, and he just brought that to the game.
You know, you talk about him being, you know, simple,
common,
modest, straightforward, but he was a funny guy. I remember in his own dry way, he was very funny. You mentioned he had eight sisters. Megan is 9 of 11 children. Mm. Her father, Vince, was one of what? He had 10 brothers?
Nine brothers, one sister.
And I remember Robin in one of the interviews said that one of the reasons he signed you was to increase home attendance. Because your family would take up three rows of seats every time that Megan got out there and played.
Well, I wondered what it was, but I couldn't quite figure it out.
What does Rob think of the film? Like, since the last time we spoke, it's now released. It's finding a great audience. What does he think?
You know, he's so humble, and I think he probably, I'm speculating. I was there when he first screened it. We did have a private screening for him, so he would have an understanding of what it was, and everything was good. And he was very emotional. And I think when you put a story together and don't really know what it's going to be about, and I think to sit there in his shoes and witness what he had a hand in creating, the ways in which he impacted lives, you know, I think his wife has said that usually you only hear those things at your funeral, sometimes never then.
Wow.
You know,
yeah,
what sort of impact you've had. So I think it's just been overwhelming, because he also never thought about those things. You know, someone had said, oh, what do you think of the film's release? And I'm like, probably won't be able to think about it for another, you know, 6 months, a year, because you're in it. He was in it. And now that he's outside of it and then seeing the film, I think it was an opportunity to really grasp. He didn't even know.
The enormity of it all.
No, I don't think any of us did.
Right.
What happened in Missoula, to really go, whoa, I didn't know that happened here. That's pretty remarkable.
One of the things the film captures is the going away party for Robin, mm-hmm. and how many former players showed up. I mean, there were well over, 100 former players came from all over the country, to celebrate his 38-year reign at Missoula with the Lady Grizz. It's incredible. And let me ask you this.
He didn't know that.
He didn't know. That's why he was so shocked to see them all.
So it was so authentic, his reaction. He knew there was going to be some people there, obviously, but he had no idea that many were showing up.
And he remembered their names and everything. So that was
name
really
takes
great.
Helped. The name takes helped. He still doesn't know my name, so.
So in 2000, you go to Hollywood, basically on a internship kind of program, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to get involved in faith-based films. And besides this one, you have some other projects. The Dating Project is a film that you produced and co-wrote and directed. You know, Prey, the story of Patrick Peyton. You know, a great film. So you've done other things. Where did the idea come from to do the movie about Robin?
I think the major moment was knowing that the reunion was happening and how many women were coming back. At the time, I was an independent producer, so you are always looking for a project. And I loved true stories and I loved documentaries, but I wasn't, you know, so you're looking, and I was at a game, and then he retires, and sometimes you just look for everything out somewhere else. And sometimes the most incredible stories, the most inspiring stories are right under your nose and living in right here. Right. So that was more luck than anything else. The reunion definitely was the reason that we started filming, because that was you can't move it.
Right. Both you and Scott have done documentary films in the past. And I want to ask you this. How do you compress a 38-year career into an hour? I mean, the final product's an hour. How do you tell a story, you know, that you know so well because you were part of the story, but how do you compress it into 38? How do you compress 38 years into an hour?
Painfully you do. There's a lot of things, and Guy, you can speak to this too, that we knew that Montana PBS, thank goodness they came on early to say at some point, you know, we want to play this film. So we knew we had to stay within a time frame. I think that helped. Otherwise, it probably could have been longer. But I'd rather people leave and say, oh, I wish that was short. You know, I wish that was longer than I wish it was shorter. So they were invaluable, Montana PBS, but they're just tough choices, tough story choices, things that you really want in there, but you don't have time. So you have to make difficult decisions. And we also knew John Sipity, the co-director, and John Lewis Kaela, the editor, which are wonderful guys that have no relation to the story at all. They're in Syracuse. And they became very big Lady Grizz fans of talking through, well, what's inside baseball and what won't a general audience get, and what things, like what choices do you need to make, and keeping each other honest about that, and making sure that our rough cut was not 5 hours long, because we have done that before. To go to five is say, okay, this first one has to be under 2 hours, and we have to get it there to begin with. So it's just difficult.
And how is it financed?
Well, initially it was financed through a fiscal sponsor. It had two fiscal sponsors, and one was the Big Sky Film Institute Foundation was as well. So donations, tax-deductible donations. And then Family Theater, where I work now, they came on board to put the finishing funds in. So they were instrumental. And Sky, you probably know this too. I mean, when it's hard moving it along, you know, section by section. When we were able to get that financing for the big chunk that said we can go back and film and we can finish editing, we all could focus. And that's why the film's finished. We could focus on it and get it done and have the resources to do that.
It's a labor of love. I would agree with you. I think getting things, moving things along, there are times where it could be valleys. You're like, oh, well, we're not doing anything on it right now. But then it picks up and then you're like, I could see the finish line. So when did that happen? What year was that?
You described it so well with the valleys and valleys that you're looking up and going, how are we going to get over that hill? Like, how are we going to get there? That was the December of 2018 is when that valley looked like it was going to be something we could get out of and climb up to and get to the finish line. That's when Family Theater asked me to pitch the project and they put in the resources. And 2019 is when we did the final filming. And then finished editing, and 2020 it played at the Big Sky Film Festival.
So tell us a little about Family Theater Productions. They have an interesting story.
They do. So Family Theater is in the heart of Hollywood. It's been there since 1947. It was founded by Father Patrick Peyton, who coined the phrase, the family that prays together stays together. And his big mission was family prayer, but within that, he wanted to positively impact media. So he worked with Jimmy Stewart. He worked with Lucille Ball, Cary Grant, all the big stars of the day.
Frank Sinatra.
Oh, just literally anybody, almost anybody you could think of from that era would be part of his productions. And they were done very well, and they were really family oriented. And obviously in some cases they were faith oriented, but he really believed in positive messaging in media. And the goal with Family Theater is to inspire, educate, and entertain, and to allow families to come together to watch film and media, whether that's digital or whether it's documentary or feature.
I watched part of the Pray, the story of Patrick Peyton. Oh. Scott, he does a audience, I don't even know what you would call it, but he was speaking in San Francisco, and he had 500,000 people there.
Oh, my God.
In San Francisco.
Where did he has that many people? Where in the Chrissy Field at Golden Gate Park?
Golden Gate Park, 500,000 people came to listen to him give his give his sermon. It was a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Rosary. He was known for the Rosary prayers. He was very charismatic and had that Irish accent that just, you know, Megan loves.
It's true. I lived there. You know it.
That she's a sucker for that Irish accent. And so that's certainly an interesting documentary, an interesting film. What are you going to work on next?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, does this project lend itself to a scripted, at some point, a scripted original, you know, screenplay for a drama?
Okay, that's a great question. And I have thought about that a lot and many times. I personally do. I mean, I don't think it could be his whole 38 years of him as a coach, but I think there's a title line to maybe Oregon State and 4,000 people that I do. And I think that's the beauty of documentaries in some capacity, is based off audience engagement, awareness, reception to a topic. It validates, okay, there's an audience here. There's an interest. There may be something more. And so I do. I personally do think that there is more to this story that could be developed.
Yeah, because it seems so inspirational just knowing it the way we've talked about it over the last couple of years. It's just, and especially a time like now when you've got this whole kind of confluence, I guess, of like the Me Too movement, you know, gender, you know, neutrality, I guess. I don't know what the word is, but we're living in a world where people identify by a variety of different ways. And here comes this amazing guy at an amazing time with a group of people who clearly in and of themselves were great athletes and believed. And how does that all kind of manifest itself to tell this incredible story? There's a lot of ingredients to this thing being happening the way it happened. And it'd be interesting to hear more about that.
I would love to talk more about that. I'd love if that, you know, it is, again, just to see where things go. And certainly that wasn't the thought initially. But as you develop and are looking at different opportunities from a particular product or this project, who knows? But yet there's so much in what happened in that time period even.
I mean, if you break some of it down, it's more than phenomenal for anybody that's interested in sports. I mean, for a 38-year career, he averaged 23 wins a year. Average. You know, that's almost unheard of. I don't even know if anybody's going to ever be able to do that again.
Incredible.
I mean, that's an incredible, lifetime achievement.
I don't think, I mean, when we started, again, I played for him. Yeah. I grew up watching the Lady Grizz. It was just like, oh, that's just what it is. We live here. That's just what happens. But you start to look like you did, and you're like, wait a minute. When 19 winning seasons before he had a loss, and you know there was a lot of injuries. Next year, he wins the conference again. It's truly unbelievable also to stay at one school for 38 years, not only by your own choice, but just being able to stay there for 38 years. It's a difficult profession, coaching. I think it's very stressful and a lot of pressure.
Were there any relationships that Robin had with certain players over the years that stand out to you as kind of just coming from two different worlds and kind of meeting in the middle and creating something greater, or, you know, conflict, but that, like, because those are the things that I think, like, a scripted piece could really tease out in a way. And it's very interesting. Yeah.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is the Native American aspect.
Mm.
But Scott, nobody, I mean, I didn't go, oh, this big thing's happened. It's sometimes when you look back and you go, whoa, that was happening.
When you're in the middle of it, you don't see how the significance is from a historical perspective.
Exactly. And now you look back, and even hearing Malia, when we interviewed her, it's not in the film. There's some wonderful footage not in the film, but she's talking about her elders coming down. I remember that. They came and they did this. They did an elders song, which is not done typically for females. They don't typically do it for females. She also got a feather in her hair, which is a very high honor. So there were these moments that you start to look back and go, yeah, I wish I would have maybe understood that better when it was happening. But I don't know that a lot of people did in the way that we do now. When we see maybe a story like this unfold, you get a grander sense of all that was happening. Certainly when the elders came and when Lilia was first recruited, that was a big deal. And that wasn't lost on anybody, because that was the first recruit to the University of Montana for a Division I scholarship in basketball. That was historic at the moment.
Very historic. You made a conscious decision not to really highlight yourself in the film. It could have been easy to do that. There were highlights. There was a highlight reel of Megan Harrington. You chose not to include any of that. Why'd you do that?
I don't think the medium could have withstood the greatness that was going to come out. I am that little girl that's in the film that dreams of being Lady Grizz. I am in it in the way that those little girls speak to what they dream of becoming. And I didn't want to be.
Well, Scott, just so you know, that Megan was a neighbor of the Selvig. She babysat for the family.
Yeah.
You know, she obviously, she was an MVP for Hellgate High School, took them to the state championship, right? In her junior year, she scored 27 points against Gonzaga and beat Gonzaga, which was a big deal for Lady Grizz. And then you had your valley you know, Megan was captain of the team, slated to, you know, be, you know, a major contributor, and then tell them what happened.
Well, I ended up against the interstate Montana State game, the first game of the conference. I blew my ACL. So, unfortunately, that was the end of my junior year. But I'm so grateful I had one more year to come back and be part of the team. And we ended up winning the conference championship that year with a lot of girls who had been hurt. But that teaches you a lot, too. You know, probably for filmmaking, too, Scott, if there's going to be those moments where all is lost or you feel pretty down and you have to get back up.
And Megan is epitomizes the being a team captain, because aren't you an all-time assist leader pretty much?
I don't know. I could not say that. I don't think I am. I would imagine it'd be Skylar or Brooklyn or.
Well, maybe at the time you became.
Let's just say I am. Who's going to fact check us? Okay.
Right. Yeah, we don't fact check.
I was also an All-American. You certainly epitomize a captain by, you know, dishing out, you know, plenty of assists. And I would assume that that role and the experience with Robin not only helped guide your work in the future, it certainly helped, you know, when you work with me. One of the things I can share, Scott, is I never had to, in 7 years, say, I wonder if Megan's going to get that done, or, you know, I wonder if that's going to happen. She was always, you know, there. I mean, never. I didn't have to worry ever. I never once ever thought. I don't think I ever told you that. But never once thought, I wonder if Megan's going to get that. I wonder if she's going to do it. I wonder if it's going to happen. I just knew it would. You know, and I think you took that same stick-to-itiveness, you know, to Hollywood. And you started at the bottom. I mean, you're already an adult woman. Mm-hmm. And you go to Hollywood. Tell our listeners how you entered the film industry.
Well, a typical story, I like to say, is jury duty. Ended up in Hollywood because of jury duty. It was a child abuse case. It was terrible. And I went to spiritual direction, which I had never done. And we talked through the case. And then I kept having this dream. And I just was like, I want to be involved with film, media, inspirational, Hoosiers, Rudy. I mean, Cinderella Man. I loved all those films. I loved the way they made me feel. And I wanted people to leave something that I was part of feeling the same way. So I applied to this program called Act One. It was a summer program, and I left the Trade Center. I left a great boss, a great job, and I burned the ships and went to LA and went through a summer program and was an intern. I was very much a non-trad intern, and I was not buying beer for any of the kids that were there with me. They were all in college. But it was very humbling and a good reminder of remembering your place. Your place in the world is to hopefully serve others. And so it was a great way to start, actually, but it was really difficult in some ways too.
You know, and Scott, you know, you, with your experience doing, you know, stuff for HBO, I mean, that's a very unusual way to get into the business.
Completely. It was, you were very vulnerable, but that's when so many good things happen, is when you're open to so many new opportunities.
Well, you had a call. Like, I mean, really, you had a calling to do this. I mean, here, I remember she told me she was going to, you know, leave the World Trade Center and go off to Hollywood. And I was completely flabbergasted by that. I didn't think she couldn't do it. It just, you know, it's like me walking into your office, Scott, and say, I'm leaving. I'm going to go join the Navy. You know, it's just something you would never, you didn't expect, but I never thought you wouldn't succeed. And now, you know, having one of the top, you know, documentary films in the country, you know, going around to not only audience acclaim, but so many people in the industry have come forward to say, this is a story that everybody should see. This is a story that I want my children to see. This is a man that, you know, we need to emulate, and, you know, his values and way of doing things, and, you know, his simple way of doing things was, you know, it's something to not only admire, but to, you know, to learn from.
Well, that's only possible too. I mean, you both know in your work, Arnie, and certainly in film, Scott, it's a team effort and it's a grind, and you only get to the finish line because of each other. And because everybody believes in the same thing, and no one person, I'm talking with you, but anybody could that worked on this sit here and have a wonderful conversation with you, because everybody was valuable in getting it to the finish line.
Sure. But you get extra points for it being your inspiration, right? I mean, it was, if you weren't here, it wouldn't have got done. It wouldn't have started. It wouldn't have come out of the gate.
Yes. Okay. With the light,
Do you, Megan, do you retain any ownership of the story or the rights, or is that all Family Theater Productions?
They are the owner of the rights of the film. That there is a situation since we brought it and it was outside that I'm still part of it in some way of ownership. A very small part, but I mean, nothing small, but they're major owners of it. So, you know, any film I work on for the company is theirs. Obviously, I work for them. Right, so this situation is different because it is a film I brought to them that was in the works. And I'm attached to anything that maybe developed from it.
Which is great. Were there plans at all to maybe do some other media platforms like a book or some other teaching kind of curriculum with it? I mean, there's so many offshoots of this that I could think of. Are you guys contemplating that?
Yes, actually, you're very familiar with this. We are talking with the Big Sky Film Institute about a curriculum for schools. I would probably be focusing Montana. They do a lot of wonderful work, the Institute there. We will do with the community screening program, where if you want to bring the film to your theater or your school, just a general discussion guide that would accompany what you license for the film for questions that you could use, you know, in a group setting.
That's great.
I think the biggest problem you would have making a film, we talked earlier about making not a documentary, but a regular scripted Hollywood film, is that Robin would probably want Harry Styles to play him as a young man and then Brad Pitt as an older coach. And I'm not sure you'd have the budget to meet Robin's aspirations.
No, we're going to have to cut him out. We're just going to have to cut Rob out of the equation. Oh, one reviewer did. You have to read it. It's so funny. He described him as a cross between Nick Nolte and Tom Brokaw. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I can see that, you know, Tom Brokaw later. Yeah, I can see a little bit of that.
I could too.
What other projects do you have going on now, Megan?
That is a great question. We are actually in the midst of working on the slate and what is next for development and some of the different kinds of projects. We did a project called the Dating Project that Arnie had mentioned earlier. And again, looking at a scripted from that as well about dating and relationships, a film kind of focusing on that. And different ones related to relationships. So there's kind of a whole different slate of ways we're going to go. And that's what we're working on. Actually, this week is what's next and what do we want to work on and focus on. The thing, you know, is this pandemic and filming.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful and I feel bad for the filmmakers who were in production or had one more shoot before they were getting ready to edit. We were thankfully finished and we're in a place for marketing and distribution. So, you know, now as things are starting to open up and looking like things might progress a little more, to kind of jump on opportunities, but what a terrible situation.
The world is opening up. Was it difficult to secure distribution through Amazon Prime?
Well, we ended up airing. Okay. So we opened at the Big Sky Film Festival and it had sold out crowds and that was also mind blowing, to see that unfold. But our distributor came about because someone from RTG Features, Slam Media, a big basketball marketing company and also film company, was looking at festivals. And Big Sky Film Festival is very well respected.
Yeah.
And so he thought, oh, sold out. So sports guy. So he contacted us. And so that happened in March, I think, about this time last year. And discussions started with them. And then they introduced us to their sister company, 1091 Pictures. So they're formerly The Orchard. So our distributor really took care of the various platforms and we'll be looking at the opportunities in streaming. So we were fortunate to have landed a really great partner in 1091 Pictures and then our marketing arm with our Five Star Basketball and RTG Features.
It's great. And what a great space to play. And you have the Jordan film that just came out at the beginning of the pandemic, which, you know, places so much, such a spotlight on the sport, but also greatness from a player standpoint. And there's just other things that are going on, especially in the documentary space that, boy, what a great time to come out with your film. to a larger audience.
Let me add something else to the Meghan Harrington story here. So it's very hard. It's very hard to do these documentaries. It's also hard to make small commercial films and make them successful. It's usually they all lose money. And Meghan was the executive producer of a film called Unplanned that was released theatrically in 2019 at a cost of $6 million, and it grossed $21
million. Wow.
Which is, in this day and age, is very hard for a small film with a small budget to gross that kind of money. How did that happen, Meghan?
I have to say, first of all, I was so limitedly involved. I introduced the book to the producers and the directors that started the ball rolling for the project. And then, you know, everybody's on different projects. And so they really deserve all the credit and all the, you know, all of the credit for what happened with the film. But it really was an issue of timing. I brought the book and suggested this as a film. They were mentor figures to me as well. 9 years before it ended up getting to the theaters. So another example. But now, again, like Scott said, it's not like every moment of the day you're working on that one project. They come and go because you have other things that come in and out. So how long it takes is not a joke in a lot of cases. But I think it was a situation of timing too. The world that movie is obviously about the Planned Parenthood director who left the organization. There was a lot of legislation that happened shortly before. So it was this firestorm of just the perfect moment for that film to release that I don't know if you could even plan something like that. You know, sometimes it's, that's the grace of God that it lines up the way it does.
Because it found an audience.
It found
a big audience. Huge. So what has been the hardest part of the filmmaking process for you? Of all the things you have to be involved in as a writer, as a director, as a producer, what's the hardest thing for you to deal with?
You know, it's all difficult. And each stage is difficult. Obviously raising money is, but when you get into, I think I'm just going to speak to the house that Rob built. When we got into those edits and the first pass came and you started that process of getting to the finished film, and it was like 26 cuts back and forth, I think over 2 months, two and a half, grueling, because you want so much for it to be perfect. You want it to resonate. You want it to be the best it can be. So I think those moments for the house that Rob built, a lot along the way, but those final steps of like, this film is getting finished. And the back and forth of refining to make it the best film it could be. And that is truly a team endeavor. Speaking of being in valleys, that's really.
Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Meghan Harrington. She is the writer, director, producer of The House That Rob Built, streaming now on Amazon Prime and done in conjunction with her production company, Family Theater Productions. We will be right back after these words.
Hunter Bay Coffee.
Back with Meghan Harrington.
So for those of you who are listening and are intrigued now and have not seen this, Meghan, how do they find the film? Where can they find it?
If you go to the House That Rob Built movie, thehousethatrobbuiltmovie.com, you'll be directed to Watch Film page or Buy Now page. You can also learn more about the film if you'd like. So that's the best way to purchase, rent, or own the film is to go to the main website, thehousethatrobbuiltmovie.com.
And there's a trailer there also, so they can get a little bit of a tease of what's in store.
Yes, and if they like the first 3 minutes, they're going to love the remaining 57.
And what's your overall expectation for the film? What happens now with this film? It's on Amazon Prime. Do you keep pushing for it to be on other platforms? I mean, what exactly is the trajectory now for this film?
Yes. So it's really important the first 90 days. I mean, first any days of the film, but the first 90 with our distributor, the reviews, the rankings, so the Rotten Tomatoes, it's huge. The reviews and the stars, like where people, how people are responding to the film, and national press. Those things, ultimately, what we would love is to be streaming. So Netflix or Amazon or any of the streaming platforms, subscription-based. But this first phase is the transactional, where you purchase or rent the film. But all of what we're doing now is trying to generate press, trying to generate awareness, try to get the stars, the reviews, people talking about the film, because that speaks to the streamer to say, oh, okay, especially a national review, Wall Street Journal, any of those major outlets or whatever it might be, can be a huge game changer. Just one of them.
Are you on the front line with that, Megan, and working with the press and the marketing group to do that?
Yes, we have a wonderful campaign lead, TJ Burden, who's leading the effort, and certainly working with him and trying to facilitate in whatever way we can. Because the relationships in Montana and the people in Montana, like this show,
right,
that have opened their airwaves or opened their book of contacts and said, hey, you know what? I'll write to so-and-so, like Gene McNulty King. We got endorsements for Tara Vanderveer, John Stockton, Muffet McGraw.
Phil Jackson.
Phil Jackson is coming. Yes, that is one. The Chelsea Clinton you had mentioned. Those are all because of Montana connections. I don't know those people, but other people do. And they were willing to go up to bat for the film and ask if they look at it and give it a chance. And kind of reminds me of what Rob did with all of his girls from small towns, ranches, and reservations. He gave them a chance. That's what we were asking. And boy, people really have been showing up. And that's made the difference.
That's incredible. Do you see this like finding a home, like as you want to be on the free streaming side, but then also could it have a home on like an ESPN that has a VOD platform or and then they have their own app and their own streaming thing? I mean, is that possible to, or like a, what is, I forget, is it We or is there some women's oriented kind of,
ESPNW too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, is there, so you're actively pursuing all those different those channels?
Well, we actually had been in touch with ESPN from the very beginning. I had contacted them through the film festival 5 years ago, whatever, 4.5 years ago. But we had already started and they had said, we take films and own them. So, you know, so like, okay, right. But during the pandemic, TJ, the marketing distribution lead said, why don't we see, you know, at that time, remember, all sports had stopped. And the pandemic had caused live sports to shut down.
Yeah.
Well, ESPN did come back and make an offer to screen the film. They were going to bundle it with another film and screen it last July. But we had used union players for the score, and they are non-union. So we could not. Now, who knows down the road if those different things can be sorted out, depending on what the trajectory of the film and you revisit things. And that was a unique period in time because they do not do that either. It was a very unique time because of the situation with sports.
Sure.
that the offer was made. But anything's possible down the road, I think, depending on how the film continues to perform.
Are you the chief's the principal spokesperson doing like podcasts and interviews, or are there others that are joining you or?
You're like, I'd like to think that we should get somebody else to be doing this. there are. Rob has been incredible. So if you want to have him on, he's been so open and willing to participate. John Sippity is available. There's subjects from the film that I know would be available and open to opportunities. So currently in this stage, which again feels like it released 5 years ago, kind of how long, it's really been 3 weeks in. So as more stories pop and more angles, there'll be something that Navajo Times on Thursday, which is a Native American focus. Hopefully that generates a lot of interest and interest in interviewing those amazing Native American women who went through the program. So we're kind of just launching into the world and looking for those different avenues of people who could speak and are in it or not in it, because you don't have to be in it, but generally that's how you would be recognized to be asked for an interview.
I'm so happy that we got to speak to you today. Thank you for your time, actually, and thank you for making this film. This is wonderful.
Megan, you're the best, and you played a significant role in building the house that Rob finally completed. So thank you for that. Thank you for your leadership and your inspiration on this. It's greatly appreciated, really.
Well, thank you both, and thank you for taking my parents' call, Ernie, and offering a job.
Well,
at
they
the
did say
them.
There was a box of candy involved. I don't know if that was the.
You're a sucker for chocolate.
No, candy's you guys. Great.
I have to, you know, again, I said this just a little bit ago, but thank you for asking me to come on and promoting the film. All this is so beneficial, and it's not lost on us that how helpful it is. So if there's a way we can help you guys, I don't know what that might be, but please let us know.
More candy. No, we're good.
Yeah, no more candy.
No more candy. Megan, thank you again.
Thanks, Megan. Arnie, I'll see you next week.
Next week, Scott. Take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
Montana.